Executor by Kat Allison. Read by Rhea 314. Executor. Noun. 1. One who executes something. Obsolete. Executioner. 2. The person appointed by a testator to execute a will. It's quiet in here for once. Quiet like it never gets in this monkey house, even at this time of night. Not that I know what time it is. If it mattered, I could turn around and look at the clock, but I'm too damn tired, and it doesn't matter anyway. 1:30, way too late. One of those single-digit hours when anyone with the sense to work a normal job be home in bed. Of course, I've never had the sense to work a normal job, so here I am, sitting in the office, with the blinds shut tight, and the overhead lights off so no one comes in and bothers me. Just the desk lamp angled down onto the pile of paper in front of me. Nothing unusual here. I've sat up like this a whole lot of nights, pushing the papers, thinking my thoughts. Nothing unusual. What the hell am I saying? There's not going to be anything usual in a station house the night after a cop funeral. Funeral. Funerals. I don't know which it should be when you do two at once. Fraser would have known. I wish I could ask him. You know something. I'm getting too old for this shit. I've said that 100 times, but now, sitting here at this desk in the small hours, it just hits me. I'm getting too damn old for this shit. I don't mean the small hours, that comes with the job, and I don't mean the pile of papers, because that comes with the job, too. Hell, that is the job. You make lieutenant and you trade your gun in for a pencil, and you've got to make yourself believe it's a good trade. It is a good trade, make no mistake about that. Why the hell should I stick my head up to get blown off by some piece of scum, when I can get shot down by the captain and the DA and the politicians instead? And that... Hell, that's just like the video games they kids play. You pop up and come back the next day and sit down behind the desk and do it all over again. That I can handle. Nah, what I'm getting too old for is the watching. Watching kids come up all bright-eyed and gung-ho, looking like they still believe in God and Rambo, and the good guys win in the end. Watching them go sour and mean, go bad sometimes, but not at the 2-7, not on my watch. And sometimes... watching them go down, down into the ground, shovel some dirt on them, say a few words, and then head back to the station house and sit behind this desk, and keep getting older, the way they never will. It's another part of the job, like the paperwork and the politics, just not one you ever get used to. I've been through it enough times that I know how it goes. I know the reason it's so quiet in here tonight is they're all still down at the bar, with all the guys from other divisions, got their dress jackets off, throwing down the drinks, telling stories and laughing too loud, trying to shake off that heavy, sick feeling you get when you hear the bagpipes and the guns firing off the salute. I've been there, I know how it goes. Sooner or later they'll stagger out, get themselves home, get to bed, and lie there in the dark thinking the thing you never say to anyone, no matter how drunk you get. Him and not me, him and not me, I'm still here, and you feel good about it. Then you feel like shit for feeling good. Not me. I don't drink like that anymore. I got no stories I feel like telling anyone. I'm not home in bed, and I'm not feeling good about any part of anything whatsoever. Feel like I got blood on my hands. And him and not me ain't making me feel any better this time round. And what I've got to do instead of sitting here moping around like this, I've got to do something with this pile of paper. That's something I should know how to handle by now. Sort it out, file it away, send it to wherever old paperwork goes to die. Tomorrow's heading towards us right on schedule, and there'll be new dead guys and all new paperwork to deal with, and I gotta tie this stuff off, let it go, and move on. So I take a breath, bang my hands a couple of times against the sides of the stack, square it up, pick up the top papers and set 'em aside to start a new pile, the legal crap pile. Don't need to look at these. I read through them enough times already, the wills. Didn't have any trouble finding them. Frazier's was in a safe with the consulate, just like you'd expect, along with his passport and Deef's papers, and some stuff of his dad's, old journals, and his death certificate. Ray's was where you'd expect, too, shoved in the back of a desk drawer in his apartment, all crumpled up behind some car magazines. No surprise there. Did get me a surprise, though, the first one. When I found out they'd named me as executor. just another one of those many things that neither of 'em saw fit to keep me appraised of. And if I'd known, I would have knocked their heads together and told them to name a lawyer, for Christ's sake. But when I found out, it wasn't funny exactly. Nothing was going to be funny that day, but it came as close to being funny as anything was going to get. So damn typical. So we read the wills, and there's the next surprise. They left everything to each other. Okay, two good buddies, close friends, single guys, no kids, not big family people. I figured I could see that. They'd each put in a clause about mutual demise, or if the other guy doesn't survive me. Which, even though it kind of gave me a chill, I give him points for smart. It's the way someone in their line of work should be thinking. Saray's money got split between his folks and Stella, and Fraser's, such as it was, between the RCMP scholarship fund and some do-gooder soup kitchen outfit in his old neighborhood I'd never heard of. No surprises there, either. But it shook me up some when I got to the end and I realized they'd been drawn up by the same lawyer, same date, same witnesses. They'd done 'em together. A guy leaving his stuff to his best buddy? Okay, I can see it. But two guys going downtown and making out their wills together? That's not at the forefront of my own personal list of things to do with a good buddy. Have a beer, catch a Bulls game, maybe. Wills? No. But what the hell? That's a done deal. Set 'em aside. Keep moving. And next up is all the other legal crap, money crap, insurance papers and bank statements, and pension fund stuff, and Ray's goddamn electricity bill and all the rest of it. They had a lawyer. This kind of pencil twiddling's in his job description. Couldn't they have left all this up to him to sort out? Hell no, not them. They never had making my life easy on their list of priorities, God knows. Thank you kindly, Mountie. Thanks a lot, Kowalski. Just like the kid, to leave me with one last mess to clean up. Kid. Even though the guy was pushing 40, I can't stop thinking about him that way. Partly because he used to act like one. I always had to ride herd on him more than any other three guys put together. Partly, I guess, because that's what he was when I first knew him. Just a kid. And they say that first impressions are the ones that stay with you. Skinny kid with glasses, all elbows and knees and attitude. I remember it real well. 1976, the year I made detective. The year things started to tank with Brenda. I was working a lot of overtime, but it still wasn't enough to fill up all those hours, and when work was over, and I was sure as hell didn't want to go home, and knew I needed to stay out of the bar, so I signed up to coach boxing. Golden Gloves. And my first week there, this kid comes through the door. Bantamweight kid, with a heavyweight attitude, running his mouth a mile a minute about how he was going to be a contender. He was going to make it all the way. He'd give a guy 30 pounds and still put him on the mat. He got the crap beat out of him a lot in the first few months. I remember it got to be kind of a joke. Oh, Christ, Kowalski's here. Better stock up on the first aid kit. But he just kept coming back, kept getting knocked on his can and getting back up, kept mouthing off, although after a while he got better at dodging a punch and learning when to shut up. And afterward, when we'd be sitting around, him trying to raise a can of pop up to his mouth and me getting the butterfly bandages, we'd get to talking. Him and his dad were pretty much on the outs by then, and I knew what that was like. Boy, did I know that one. Up one side and down the other. And he was looking, the way kids will do. Looking for someone who could give him some clues about how to grow up, and what to do with all that crazy energy he had running around in him. Someone who could maybe tell him how to be a man. So we'd sit around and talk after most of the other guys had gone and it was quiet in there, just like it is in here now. He knew I was a cop. They all did. And one day he started talking about how he was thinking about maybe being a cop himself. Getting the bad guys, doing good deeds, being a hero. The usual bullshit you think about when you're a kid. I told him forget about it. It's not like that. It's hard, dirty work. I told him to get out of the streets and to get to college and make a decent life for himself. But he didn't listen to what I was trying to tell him, the way kids never do. Then this happened and that happened. Brenda put in the divorce papers. I crawled into a bottle for a few years. And when I crawled out again, one day I found a note on my desk, asking for a letter of recommendation for one Stanley Raymond Kowalski in support for his application to the academy. I cursed him out for a while in my head, told him he was a stupid son of a bitch, and then I wrote the letter and sent it off. On his graduation day, I was there in the crowd. His parents didn't show, the jerks, and I shook his hand and told him I'd hope he'd learned some sense since his glory days in the ring. He'd quit boxing by then. He was married, and even though he was still so full of himself, it was damn near spilling out his ears. I remember thinking that maybe things would turn out okay for him after all. Maybe he'd be one of the ones who could make this gig work and come out okay on the other side. He sure believed it back then, bright-eyed and gung-ho, so damn happy that day. And I can't sit here thinking this kind of stuff. It's not getting the job done. I got the legal paper sorted out, mostly. Bills that still have to be paid over here, death certificates in that folder there. Next thing up in the pile is Ray's personnel file, which for some Christ-saken senseless reason I pulled out and went through the other night. Not like I need it. I know his record. I kept tabs on him all those years he was working down at the 12th, doing his job, getting the bad guys, getting his commendations. I used to run into him every once in a while, and we'd have a beer and shoot the shit. He got scuffed up a bit with time, the way we all do. Got some of the shine knocked off him, got some shadows around his eyes and an edge in his voice. But he was still a damn good cop, which is what counts. And I was... okay, I was proud of him. Close up that personnel file. Close up that personnel file. Move along. Nothing more to see here. Drop it on the floor to give to Betty tomorrow to take down to the basement and file away. It won't see the light of day again. The case files, two of them. Those are next. Kowalski, Stanley R., Frazier, Benton. Pretty thin compared to a lot of the files I've seen. No big mystery to investigate. No long records of interviews or stakeouts or anything. Just some photos and a few reports and the stuff from Mort's. No loose ends. Case closed. We know how this one went down. But I open up the file, Ray's file, and I flip through it one more time. Transcript of his call for backup from his car. I'd listen to the tape later. He'd sounded pretty normal, pissed off, but no more than usual, not panicky or anything, like he had things under control. But then, at the end, he stops in the middle of what he's saying, and you can hear him yelling, "Frazier!" And then the tape cuts out. The photos and the reports tell you the rest of the story. Not that I need 'em. I can see it all in my head, as clear as if it were the movie of the week. Bad guy takes off into the flop house. Frazier lights out after him. Ray ends up chasing both of them like it's Keystone Cops. Up the stairs, out onto the roof, shots exchanged. Ray, dumb schmuck, empties out his clip, and then... I can see it plain as day. I know just how it went down. Frazier stands up, like the stupid, insane idiot he is, was. Stands up, no gun, no vest, no nothing. And Ray sees what's about to happen. It wasn't anything I hadn't seen before, that move of Frazier's, that I'm a good guy, so I'm just going to stand here like the broadside of a barn, and you're not going to shoot me because I've got this big red S on my chest. The only surprise in the whole deal was that it worked out as long as it did. I knew someday he'd come up against some piece of scum who didn't give a shit that he helped old ladies across the street. Always figured this day would come for him. What I didn't figure... I figured Ray would know better, okay? Thought he'd learned some sense. I'd seen him have the brains to stay down when that bald-headed guy started throwing knives around. He wasn't harboring a death wish, and he didn't have any illusions about appealing to the better side of the criminal element. He knew no one's bulletproof, and even Superman died a while ago. He knew no one's bulletproof, and even Superman died a while ago. I should have remembered that first case. The very first time those two go out together, and Ray comes back with a big dent in his Kevlar vest and a weird way of moving the next few days, that tells me he took a bad bruise. I finally asked Frazier point blank what happened, and of course he coughed it up, and I called Ray in and chewed the hell out of him and let it go. Told him not to be such a damn idiot next time. I should have known right then. If I'd had my branding gear, should have known that I'd do better to split those two up, then and there, and screw the cover story. So, it's right there in the photos. All you got to do is look at 'em, and you can tell. Scuff marks in the gravel. You can tell Ray jumped, fast, sideways. Gravel dug into the side of his face. You can tell he fell hard. He had his vest on. Too bad the bullet caught him in the neck. The bullet he knew was meant for Frazier. The one he took instead. Not that it did any good. Frazier, top of the head, centered, neat as you please. Not a mark on him anywhere else. You'd hardly know a thing was wrong except for all the blood in his hair. He must have been bending over Ray, probably yelling his name the way he always used to. He fell on top of him, kind of draped over, like he was trying to protect him, even though he was probably dead by the time he landed. And that's how it ended for them, together on that tenement rooftop. By the time the paramedics showed up, there was nothing left to do but load him up. Nothing they could do for the shooter, either, which is one thing that makes me happy in the whole stinking mess. I don't know where the hell Deef was when things went down, getting a little older and slowing up, maybe, which I can sure understand, but by the time they got there he'd taken the guy's throat out. Better death than he deserved, for sure. They had to trank dart Deef to get him out of there, and we've been hiding him out at the vet clinic in the burbs ever since the jerk-offs from animal control started yapping about how they were going to have him put down as a dangerous animal. I told him, they touched that wolf over my dead body. Anyone takes out a cop killer should get a medal. Went down to visit him yesterday, feeling like an idiot, but he wouldn't even look at me. Just lay flattened out on the floor of his cage. That Frobisher guy is going to take him along, thank God, when he heads back north tomorrow. The wolf, and take Fraser's ashes. I showed him the directions in the will, where Fraser wanted him scattered, and he studied it for a minute and said he knew the exact spot. Fine, good, better him than me. It's not like I've got time to go chasing off to the ass end of the Arctic. I got enough to do here. And I'll be glad to get that Frobisher out of my hair. He's worse than Fraser ever was when it comes to long, pointless stories. I'm not trying to be a jerk about it, but I couldn't handle it. All the stuff about what Fraser was like when he was a kid. All the great Mountie stuff he did before he came down here. That's fine, that's wonderful. But I don't want to hear it. But I don't want to hear about it right now. So Fraser was Dudley Do-Right. I already knew that. And all I know right now is that he got one of my men killed. Got Ray killed. It was about more than I could handle at the funeral. Everyone in the city must have been there, and all of them wanted to yap at me about the wonderful Benton Fraser. What a hell of a guy he was, how much he'd be missed. This one bozo, guy I didn't even know, he kept going on, and I told him to get the hell out of my face before I broke his face for him. And that's when Vecchio came over and hauled me out of there, put me in a car, and drove me back to the station. He must have gotten smarter during his time away. Because the only thing he said to me, the whole drive was, Benny really was the most annoying man on the planet, you know? And we ended up laughing, kind of. Vecchio wasn't supposed to be here at all, of course. It might have been a stupid career move, but I still think calling him up was the one smart thing I did that day, that first afternoon when the news came in. I don't remember a lot about that afternoon, which drives me crazy. I may be getting old and growing a gut, but my head's still good. I remember I was going through some papers, some budget crap, just a normal day, had my door open, with all the usual brouhaha going on in the big room, and then all of a sudden it got real quiet out there, and then I heard Franny scream. I figure someone's just pulling some shit on her, some stupid cop-type joke like bringing body parts up from the meat room. So I got up and started out, ready to bang heads, and there was Huey in the doorway, and he pushed me back inside and shut the door. He told me then. I remember seeing the tears running down his face and wondering why he didn't at least try and wipe them off. He kept saying, Ray and Fraser, Fraser and Ray, they're dead. I remember I was thinking it had to be Vecchio. Maybe Vecchio had been back in town and Fraser had run into him, said something dumb and gotten them both killed. Just the kind of thing Fraser would do. Bad luck, stupid luck, but at least it made sense. I don't know what I was saying, but finally Huey popped me one in the chest, just blam, with the heel of his head, and yelled, Kowalski, you stupid son of a bitch! It was Kowalski got killed! And then he stopped, and turned around, and took off out of the room, like I was going to be pissed at him or something. Like that mattered. I don't remember things too clearly after that. I remember thinking I had to get out to the scene, take a look at things, take charge. And I remember walking down that hallway, everyone stepping back to give me room. I was kind of dizzy, like I couldn't feel the ground very well. Or maybe, like the hallway was a lot longer than it usually was. I remember Elaine was there, in her uniform, down at the end of the hallway, just coming in after hearing the news, and she stopped me, put her hands on my arm and told me there wouldn't be anything to see there. The forensics guys were taking care of it, and that I didn't want to go out front just now. I remember I went out anyway, just a few steps, and there was a big crowd out there. I remember some guy shoved a microphone in my face, and I shoved him into the wall, and then they pulled me back in, Elaine and Huey and someone else. Elaine was crying, too. I remember that. I went down to the meat room a while later. Mort wasn't singing, for once. He looked even older than I felt. He didn't want to let me come in the room, and I was getting tired of people standing in my way. "You cutting him up, Mort?" I was looking over his shoulder. I didn't want to, but I couldn't stop myself. "That's what you're up to?" "I'm doing my job," he told me. "My job is with the dead. Yours is with the living. I suggest you return to it." He stopped a moment and looked at me, and then said, "I will disfigure them no more than is absolutely necessary." I don't even know why I went down there. I've seen plenty of dead guys in my lifetime. It's not like I need to see two more. I told him that, and he turned me around and took me back out into the hall. I kept it all pretty well together, told him I was sorry to interrupt his work, and he told me to forget it. And then he told me to wait for a minute, and he went back inside. When he came out, he had a Ziploc bag in his hand. "Constable Fraser's possessions will, I assume, be returned to the consulate," he said, "but I thought you might be the appropriate one to receive these." He handed me the bag. I could see what was in it. Ray's billfold, his wristwatch, that stupid bracelet, his shield. I think I lost it then for a while. I remember Mort steering me into the bathroom so I could throw up. And then I got back to my office and shut the door and ignored the ringing phone and spent what seemed like an hour looking for that piece of paper, the one I'd put away real careful so I could find it again. Couldn't for the longest time remember where I'd put it. When I finally found it, I dialed the number, the one I wasn't even supposed to call. The red button launched the missile's number. I talked some mumbo-jumbo code crap, and I left a message, and a few hours later Vecchio came in the door, looking about 10 years older than the last time I'd seen him. So I'd flushed our chance to take down the bookman's buddies. Big fucking deal. You take them out, 2 days later there's 50 guys fighting to take their place. There's a never-ending supply of scum, I know that. Doesn't mean you don't keep doing your job. And if you have to lie and tap dance and play party games to do it, then that's what you do. But one thing I know for sure, one thing you don't do, not ever, not in this world, you don't bury a guy under another guy's name. You don't do that. That's what I told Vecchio, and that's what I told the asshole from the FBI who showed up later, steam coming out his ears. He wanted to argue about it. He wanted to make sure I knew just how much trouble I was in, and just who he was going to talk to about it. And I finally told him to shut the fuck up and get the fuck out of my office. I'm sure he's got a piece of paper he's filed with the feds with my name on it, like I give a damn. What's one more piece of paper? They can stick it right next to the letter I'm sure the superintendent's written up on me, after we had our little dialogue about the funeral. They'd both left real clear instructions, cremations what they wanted. He had a whole paragraph in there about how the body's just a shell, and he didn't want the fragile terrain of whatever, the permafrost or something, to be disturbed on his account, and so on and so forth, until I could almost picture the lawyer rolling her eyes. Ray skipped all the explanations, but I know what it was with him. The kid didn't want to be nailed up in a box and have to lie still for all eternity. Fits. Made sense for both of them, even if it didn't. It's not my call, it's what they wanted. But you try telling that to the brass. The superintendent came down in person, like a state visit from the Pope or something, to talk to me about it. Gave me a whole line about how a funeral's for the survivors, and I caught funerals about ritual and solidarity, and showing the colors, and how you need the march to the gravesite for symbolic reasons, and the emotional closure of putting someone in the ground, and on like he was reading a script from the goo heads in counseling. Like he could snow me with that crap. I just told him I was doing the job I'd been given, following orders, and a dead cop's orders trump a superintendent's. So what we did, we had a service up at St. James, not that either of them was religious, and then the whole cortege headed down to the lake, and we stood there freezing our asses off while everyone made some more speeches. We had the guns and the bagpipes, and then his folks got in a boat and motored out a ways and tossed Ray's ashes in there. They thought that'd be nice. I didn't have the heart to remind them that the kid fucking hated water. The only way you ever got him out in the lake was when the Mountie dragged him out there. So I guess it fits, come to think of it. 3,000, the new guy said. That's how many there were. Closed down Lakeshore Drive for a while. I guess we pissed off a lot of citizens. Screw 'em. I am almost through the pile in front of me. There's just one thing left, and it's the one thing I don't want to touch. A manila envelope, 11x14, taped shut. I know what's in there. I don't want to know what's in there, but I do. I don't want to look at it again, and I don't know what to do with it. It'd been in the big box Stella Kowalski hauled over here late last night. I guess she figured out where she could find me. She had a strange look on her face. Not so much like she'd been crying, which she had, but strange. That blank-eyed, shocky look. The one family members get when you show up at the door and give them bad news. She dropped the box on the floor, told me, "I've been cleaning out Ray's apartment, disposing of his belongings, with authorization from his parents. I came across some things that are clearly not his, and thought, as executor, you should decide on their disposition." She had her best assistant state's attorney attitude on, but her voice was a little shaky. Gave me a look like she was pissed off at me. Not that that was anything new from that lady. I swear I don't even know what he ever saw in her. And then she turned and headed out the door before I could say anything. I opened the box, and there at the top was a steel dog dish, some cans of Ian's. What the hell, so the wolf had dinner over at Ray's sometimes. So what? Couldn't figure out why she'd hauled that over. Then a pile of clothes. They looked just like any guy's clothes to me, a pair of jeans folded up on top. Then I pulled them out and realized that they'd had the touch of an iron, crisp crease pressed into them. Underneath were a couple of white Henleys that looked familiar, but it took me a minute to remember they were what Fraser always used to wear under his uniform jacket, the few times I'd seen him unbuttoned. I kept going, more jeans, a few shirts, some red long johns, underwear. All of it, even the boxers, pressed to a sharp finish. Not Ray's style, if you know what I mean. Something was shaping up in my mind that I wasn't sure I wanted to look at, but hell, I'm a detective, used to be, and so I acted like one. I looked in the tags, and it struck me that the jeans were a couple of inches bigger in the waist than Ray would ever wear. Dress shirt with a 16 neck, which Ray would have swum in. I guess, even apart from the ironing, a woman know the size clothing her ex would wear. Hell, she'd probably used to shop for him. She'd know which ones weren't his. There was more stuff under the clothes, a bunch of books. Melville, Kipling, someone named Bruce Chatwin. Herodotus, for Christ's sake. In Latin. I opened the cover on the first one, and there was Benton Fraser, written in nice, smooth script. Same name written in each of them. No big surprise there. It's not like I'd have thought Herodotus would be Ray's thing anyways. He's more of a Tom Clancy kind of guy. I set the books down on the floor, leaned back. So okay, they were sharing a place, so big deal. Rent's expensive in this town. It's not like either of them was making large money. And I told myself I was just glad Fraser had finally gotten out of that broom closet at the consulate. I went to pile everything back in the box, and then I saw at the bottom there was a manila envelope. Nothing written on the outside, taped shut with lots and lots of tape, kind of lumpy and wrinkled, like it was done fast. I picked it up and turned it around for a while and looked at it. Nothing written on the outside. Not much inside, I could tell by feeling it. Just some papers. Something in my gut was telling me to leave it alone, toss it out. Something Ray probably would have called intuition or instinct. Some horseshit like that. Me, I'm just a dumb cop. I call it my gut, and usually, dumb or not, I'm smart enough to pay attention to it. But I wasn't hitting on all cylinders just then, and all I could think was, well, hey, it's an envelope, let's open her up. Which is what I did, took out my pocket knife and cut the tape open, and slid out a stack of paper. The top sheet was just a plain piece of bond, with a bunch of writing on it. Fraser's handwriting. I recognized that clear enough. It looked like a poem he'd copied out or something. Lots of short lines. I didn't read it at first. I was more curious about the pages underneath. They felt different to my fingers. That kind of thick, rough paper artists use. Like I remember from way back when Brenda was taking art classes. I lifted off the top sheet and set it aside. And there, looking up at me, was a drawing. I knew Fraser could draw, sure. I never knew he could draw like that. I laid the papers out side by side until I had a little gallery there on my desk. They were all the same thing, basically, done with a soft pencil or charcoal, maybe. What the art guys call figure studies, I guess, not that I know art. and what they call figure studies are what I'd call naked women. All the ones I'd seen, at least. But these weren't of women. Naked, though. A naked guy. A specific naked guy. Ray Kowalski. They were pretty similar, all of them. Ray lying on a bed. The bed was kind of sketchy, but you could see that it was messed up or rumpled. Ray was on his side, sometimes, or on his back, or lying on his stomach. You could tell he was asleep in each of them, all sprawled out with that relaxed look people have when they're sleeping. And you could tell it was Ray for sure. Fraser had a knack for getting a face. Not that he was a slouch in depicting other body regions, as I discovered. My brain was pretty much in shock, but I remember I kept thinking that Fraser must have been to art school sometime. Not just because they were that good, but I also remember thinking they teach you in school to sign your work. He put his initials at the bottom of each one, BF, just like he was Pablo fucking Picasso or something, and then the date. The first one was from several months ago. The last one. I stared at that one for a while. It was a week to the day before the shooting. It was kind of a close-up of Ray lying on his side asleep, one arm folded down across his chest so you could see that stupid tattoo. He looked relaxed. He looked happy. Finally, I picked them all up and stacked them together. My hands were shaking. I knew, as clear and as hard as I'd ever known anything in my life, that I shouldn't have seen these, that they weren't my business, not anyone's business, no one but theirs. I had forgotten about the other paper, the one with the writing on it, but when I had finally gotten the drawings shuffled together and shoved back in the envelope, fast and hard, there it was, staring up at me. I really didn't want to read it. I really didn't want to read it. But once you open a case, you have to close it. And that means looking at everything that comes across your path, like it or not. I smoothed it out, put on my glasses, and read it all the way through. Ray. I turned from side to side, from image to image to put you down, all to no purpose. For you the rhymes would not ring. I started to copy this out for you, a justification for my cowardice, and then I thought, no, at least let me have the courage, this once, my own words and no one else's. My father taught me how to build a fire, by leaving me to learn it on my own. I was a boy of six, he was the hero. He turned and walked away and left me holding a piece of flint, wet tinder, and a stone. I know it took me hours to get it going. I learned to make a fire out of stone. But to this day I don't recall the fire, just the dark and cold and being all alone. He died and I went south to be a hero. I found I couldn't do it on my own. I found a friend who helped me bear the city, who tried to make me feel I had a home. I almost lost us both in the wildfire. I built to keep from turning into stone. I learned with pain that passion is a liar, and love a cheat I couldn't let outwit me. I learned those lessons in the dark, alone. And when my house burned down and I discovered, my friend was gone and I was left alone. I couldn't grieve, it's what my father taught me. He turned and walked away to be a hero, and heroes have to travel on their own. I couldn't see the gift that loss has brought me. I thought I'd learn from every loss I'd suffered, that I'd do the best to turn myself to stone, and I a rock and you a flinty stranger, could travel side by side, though each alone. But you taught me a lesson I'd forgotten. When flint strikes rock, the spark can make a fire I didn't have to build alone. I tried to live the lesson life had brought me, to turn my back and walk away from fire. I tried to walk away from my desire, so hard to learn instead of the things you taught me, the opposite of everything I'd known. You didn't walk away, you wouldn't leave me. You wouldn't let me do it on my own. You taught me heroes travel best together, and fire, when hot enough, can shatter stone. And sometimes I'm not sure that I can stand it. This fire of joy, this blaze I've never known, to lie in darkness warm and not alone. I thought that I had turned my heart to granite, but you can make a fire out of stone. Well, that's fairly dreadful, isn't it, Ray? And I'm sure you'll conclude, justly, that I'm as wooden a poet as I am a backup singer. Wordy as ever, and still the words say nothing of what I need to say. Perhaps, after all, I shouldn't have tried. Perhaps you're right. And there's nothing that really needs to be said. and it is my virtue that I cannot give you out, that you are absorbed into my strength, my mettle, that in me you are matched, and that it is silence which comes from us. Silence. I finished reading. I sat staring at it, and all I could think was for a minute, it almost been like I could hear Fraser's voice talking again, saying stuff I never knew he had in him. But when I shut my eyes, all there was silence. Fuck. 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 That was not anything I wanted to be seeing. Nothing I wanted to know about. I know I signed on for a lot of shit when I took this job, but this was nowhere on the list. And yeah, you're right about one thing, Fraser. It is a crappy poem, and yeah, you shouldn't have said any of it. Any of it. Shouldn't have let any of it happen, should have let things be. But shutting up and letting things be was never your strong point. I'm staring down at the envelope, and I don't know what to do about it. Don't know what to think about any of it. But the one thing I do know, I know that if Benton fucking Fraser walked in the door this minute, big as life and twice as red, I come round this desk and take him by the neck and just slam his head into the wall until he's shut up forever. Selfish, selfish son of a bitch. But getting pissed at a dead man's a waste of time. Be a rock, Welsh. That's what my old Lou used to tell me, Trotman, back when I was a rookie and things get to me. Back before he took a heart attack one night, sitting at his desk and keeled over, which is probably how I'll go out one of these nights. Be a rock. It's something I learned. It's something I tried to teach the kid, something that would have been more help to him than all that stuff I tried to teach him about dodging a left hook. I remember we went out for a drink one time, right after Stella dumped him. He was a mess. He was doing that hard guy thing, on the outside, and it was just like when he was a kid and I used to watch him in the ring. He'd get knocked on his ass and he'd climb back up again, giving the other guy the eye fuck and trash-talking at him, and you knew the whole time his legs were barely holding him up. So he's trying to show me what a tough guy he is, telling me he's fine, doing fine, probably better off without her, talking real hard and real fast and pounding down the beers. And finally I grabbed his arms and told him to shut up. And then once he shut up, and he just sat there shaking, I kept a hold of his arm and I told him it's the price of the ticket on this ride, that it's hard to be a cop and have anyone in your life, that doing this job makes you different from other people. You don't get to be like the rest of him anymore. It sets you apart. I told him that's the way it is, and that he'd learn to deal with it and it'd get better. I was talking out of my ass, of course. Ray Kowalski was never going to learn to deal with it. He wasn't a guy to handle the idea of being alone the rest of his life. But I wasn't thinking too clear at the time. I just figured he'd fight it a while, and then he'd finally deal, just like I did. What the hell was I thinking? That maybe he'd grow up to be like me? So I was stupid about it. Hell, I've been stupid about plenty of things. Fraser. I'd even managed to be stupid about him. If there was ever anyone you'd figured had a grip on the concept of learning to deal with being alone, I figured he had that one forward, backward, by heart, carved in stone. I'm a good lieutenant, but it doesn't make me smart about people. What I should have told Ray then, that night in the bar, he was talking about getting out, telling me he didn't have any idea why the fuck he wanted to be a cop in the first place. The job sucked. He was fed up with it. He didn't give a shit anymore. And I could have told him then. I could have said, you go for it, kid. Get the hell out while you can. While you're still young enough to make some kind of real life for yourself. Before you're like me, too old for anything else. Too old to do anything but sit in front of a desk at 2 a.m. looking at a pile of papers and thinking about dead guys. I don't know why I didn't. I don't know what the hell I was thinking. I wasn't thinking, is what scares me when it comes down to it. Okay, I was scared. Don't ask me why. It scared me, the way he was talking. The way a cop talks who's setting himself up to get in trouble, get himself killed. So what I told him instead, I said there was an opening coming up the 2-7, undercover. Told him he'd want to think it over, and he'd have to go through the channels, but if he wanted it, I'd grease it. And that it'd make a change, give him a chance to have a fresh start over. Start over, yeah. I was thinking I could keep an eye on him, thinking maybe working with the Mountie'd remind him why he got into this in the first place, that it'd straighten him out. Oh, yeah. I should have known something was weird. As time went on, my gut was telling me there was something hinky there, but I didn't do anything. Hell, I went along with it, even after I found out he'd got herring off to Sault Ste. Marie and gotten dunked in the middle of Lake Superior, even after he dropped through that skylight and jumped that motorcycle through a window like he was freaking Steve McQueen instead of skinny-ass Ray Kowalski. All those damn stupid things he did, all because the Mountie was following the Gleam and steering the train off a cliff, and Ray wouldn't let him take the dive on his own. And I went along with it. Could have split him up, but I didn't. Told myself it was because they had a real good solve rate, made a hell of a good team, real productive together, all kinds of BS like that. But you come down to it, it was because Ray was looking happy, for the first time since things went in the crapper with Stella, and I liked seeing him happy. As if anyone with sense believes you get to be happy in this life. That's the kind of garbage the civilians believe, the ones who go through life like a bunch of sheep, thinking nothing's going to hurt them, thinking the Constitution guarantees them the right to some happiness. Maybe they're stupid enough to believe it. Maybe I was stupid enough to want Ray to have it. Stupid enough to lose my grip on the fact that trying for happy just slows you down, dumbs you down, puts a big hole in the wall, big enough for something to come through and take your head off. When you're a cop, when you get your shield, they tell you your job's to protect citizens, but you learn soon enough that what comes first is you take care of each other. You hang together. You watch the other guy's back. You go to the wall for another cop. And when you make lieutenant, your job is to take care of your man, whether they're getting shot at by scum or hammered by the brass. You do what you have to do to keep him alive and keep him working. And if that means swallowing enough crap to fill Comiskey Park, you do it. If it means making him unhappy sometimes, you do it. And mostly I did. Swallowed the crap and covered their backs. Thought I was doing it right. Told my gut to shut up and thought everything was aces. And now I'm sitting here with their blood on my hands. That's what's killing me. I could have stopped this train wreck anywhere back up the line. I mean, okay, Frazier, write that one off. I liked the guy, sure. I respected him. Hell of a good man. But even I could tell. I'm no Gene Dixon. But even I could have told the RCMP not to waste any money on his pension fund, because he'd never collect it. The guy had a death wish the size of fucking Dominion of Canada. That's the only way I can make sense of it. He should have been killed 50 times over before this. I was never able to do a thing to knock sense into him. No way you could watch his back 24/7. But Ray, God damn it to hell, I could have kept him out of this. Maybe I should have talked to his dad way back when, way back at the beginning. And I was all too ready to believe the old man was just an asshole. Kills me to say it, but he was right all along. I could have written a letter that would have kept him out of the academy for sure, thought about it. But all the time, the whole time I was cursing him out for being a stupid idiot in my head, I was getting a kick out of it. Made me feel good, just like it did when he came over to the U7. I never had a kid, never will now, and Ray, I wanted him to learn some stuff. Wanted to have him around and teach him a few things. Wanted him to grow up like me, I guess. Yeah, Harding fucking Welsh. Who's the real selfish son of a bitch here? And I'll have plenty of time for this later. Plenty of small hours to chew that one over before the coronary puts me in the ground. And meanwhile, none of this is getting me any further on what I need to do right now, which is figuring out what to do with this goddamn envelope full of paper. I set it down on my desk and push my chair back, try to wipe some of the grit out of my eyes, and all of a sudden I get an idea. I dump out the waste paper basket on the floor, and I open up the envelope, being careful to pull out the papers upside down so I don't have to look at them again. Tear them up into little strips and drop them into the waste basket. Then I get my desk drawer open, shove stuff around, and way in the back. Yeah, it's still there, the gold lighter Brenda gave me on our anniversary, back when I thought I was going to be a happy man. The one I never got around to throwing out, even after I quit smoking. Flick it a few times, still fires up just like new. Imagine that. Fight with the window for a while before I can get it open. Probably hasn't been opened in 20 years. When I finally get it all the way open, I put my hands on the sill and lean out for a minute, smelling the fresh air. Cold nights, wind coming in off the lake and some snow along with it. I'm not sure this'll work, but once I get the stuff lit and tilt the wastebasket out the window, the wind does its job, carries the smoke out of my office and away. Doesn't take long until all that's left is a pile of ashes. I wait a while until my hands start getting cold, and I'm pretty sure the ashes are cool. Then I pound them out with my fist until they're dust. Nothing left that even the brightest bulb of a document examiner can figure out. Yeah, it's just ash I got in my hand now, not blood. I wipe it off on my pants. So that's the last of the paper taken care of. My work here is done. And just for a minute, as much of a pain in the ass as this job's been, for a minute I feel good that they gave it to me. Pain in the ass, yeah, but they figured I'd do right by them. And as much as I fucked up some things, I gave it my best shot. But that's being sentimental, and I'm not a sentimental kind of guy. If I was, I'd probably hang on to the ashes and scatter them somewhere. Maybe over the lake. Maybe give them to that wacko Frobisher to mix in with Fraser's and haul back up north. God knows he wouldn't see anything weird about it. But I'm just a cop, and the streets are as good a place to me as any. And that's where I send them. Tip the basket and watch the wind mix them up with the snow and carry them off over the city. Where it started. Where it ended. The End. If you've enjoyed this story, please leave feedback for the author. You can do that at a link to the text through this story's post. Thanks for listening.